This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi. And this is The Exchange. As Americans observe Election Day by casting their ballots, our thoughts turn to the founders of our democracy. Prominent among them is Thomas Jefferson, drafter of the Declaration of Independence, our first Secretary of State, and third President. But Jefferson's legacy touches on much more than politics. It includes education, agriculture, science, architecture, music, and religion. Nor is it free from contradictions. The plantation aristocrat struggled throughout his life to reconcile his own slave ownership with his vision of a more egalitarian society. In a new book, co-authors Annette Gordon Reed and Peter Onuf take on the misconceptions surrounding Jefferson's life to present a portrait of how the man imagines himself as the patriarch of his home, family, and country. Today on The Exchange, reconsidering Thomas Jefferson. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me this morning from New York is Annette Gordon Reed. She is co-author with Peter Onuf of Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of Imagination. She's the Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School and the Carol Forsheimer Professor at the Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Study at Harvard University. Professor Gordon Reed is a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award for her work on the Hemingses of Monticello, as well as a MacArthur Fellow. Professor Gordon Reed, thanks for joining us on The Exchange this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin by asking you about your motivation for writing this book now. Is this a natural progression in the scholarship on Thomas Jefferson, or is there some other reason that motivated you to take on the project?
Well, I am supposed to be doing a two-volume biography of Jefferson at some point in the future, and I decided, along with my co-author and friend Peter Onuf, that this book would be a good way for me to begin that process, to think about Jefferson in a way that I had not thought about him before. Peter is an intellectual historian, and I do, and he does some political history, but I do political history and social history, and he is an expert in Jefferson. So we thought we would sort of combine forces to have a much more, to give me a sort of look into Jefferson's mind before I actually go off and do the sort of soup to nuts look at his life. So this is in preparation for something else, and we also thought it would be a good thing for Jefferson scholarship at this particular moment to sort of reassess what we should be thinking about him at this particular moment.
And we should mention that Peter Onuf is also a renowned scholar on Thomas Jefferson. You're a co-author in this book. So is this the first volume of a two-volume project, or is this in preparation for actually moving on to those two volumes?
It's in preparation for moving on to those two volumes. So this is a thought piece, and it's a way to get into Jefferson's mind. Peter was the Thomas Jefferson Foundation professor down at UVA. Mm-hmm. He retired last year. So he spent his life looking at, not his life, but a good part of his time looking at Jefferson's intellectual development. I sort of know those things from my other work, but not, you know things better when you prepare to write a book about it, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's the best way to learn, is to learn in preparation of talking to other people about it. So, yeah, this is a preparation for me.
And where do you see, obviously it's still in the planning stages, but where do you see this two-volume work taking you?
Well, it's still in the planning stages. I was going to, you know, so much has come out about Jefferson. We have, in a different world, and there have been many great biographies about him. I think John Meacham's book, Jefferson and the Art of Power, was very, very good, but it's one volume, and there are some topics that you just cannot cover in one volume. And Duma Malone, who did the great biography of Jefferson, six volumes, I'm not going to do that, sort of went through every single phase. But I'm going to try to split the difference here and give a little bit more than you might be able to do in a in one volume biography, but at the same time, allow me to sort of stretch out on some subjects about the plantation, about Jefferson's time in Charlottesville and that area, things that you don't typically get as much in a biography.
Right, right. You know, I've noticed over the years that that books on historical figures often come in boomlets, and I'm interested in your opinion on this. You know, we had a while back, we had a Lincoln boomlet. Then I think that was followed by a Teddy Roosevelt boomlet. first of all, do you think we are in a Jefferson boomlet? And if so, why do you think the renewed interest in him as a president and as a statesman?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the revelations about his life at Monticello among enslaved people. We have begun to think about slavery much more in American historiography. We've been doing it for many, many years, but we haven't really focused on the founders and their relationship to slavery. We talk about whether they were for it or against it, but the actual mechanics of their lives at their plantations, Jefferson, Washington, you know, it's a relatively new subject in the field of this kind of scholarship.
Right.
But also, I think the revelations about Jefferson and Sally Hemings and the creation of a family or his connections to the Hemings family overall gives you a different window into life at Monticello. So I think it's made people reassess to think about him in a different way because you just kind of have to. Well, I remember when the week that the DNA tests,
right,
you know, came out back in 1998, a journalist said to me, I was doing a phone interview, and he said, "I never really thought of Jefferson as a slave owner until now," you know, which I thought was kind of interesting. But I do think for a number of people, it's a different look to say, wait a minute, we have to pay attention not just to Jefferson the politician or his sort of theoretical writings about slavery. You want to know what actually happened.
And I should mention, and we'll get to this in a little bit, that much of this reassessment is really a function of your own Pulitzer Prize-winning work on the Hemingses of Monticello. So you've really been right in the middle of this reassessment of Thomas Jefferson as a slave owner. One other kind of general question. I'm always interested to hear what scholars of presidents think. You know, I'm a political scientist in my day job, and I'm often asked to complete these surveys. You may see them as well. You know, ranking the presidents. And over the years, I've seen some presidents like Dwight Eisenhower and Polk. James Polk also comes to mind. I've seen them move up these lists of presidential rankings pretty dramatically based on new scholarship. I guess I'm interested just sort of in your general sense, you know, of how Jefferson is kind of viewed typically as a president, not even so much from scholarship point of view, but just kind of generally. And, you know, do you sense that his reputation is trending one way or the other?
Well, I think Jefferson as a president, I mean, when I do those surveys, I think I always put him at like number five or something. He's definitely in the top 10, and he typically appears in the top 10. It, like many presidents, the first term was more exciting and more successful than the second term. He sort of ran into some problems with the embargo and various issues for the second term. But I think his reputation as a president kind of holds steady. I think what people are interested in about Jefferson is Jefferson the person.
Right.
There's been such I think more than almost any other president, maybe Lincoln, but Jefferson, people look at him, the man. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's a stake that people have in him and his personality.
Well, I think because, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, so it's sort of a fascinating thing because people either want to love him or want to hate him.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to watch because, you know, for me as a person who gets accused very often of trying to destroy him and at the same time by other people trying to apologize for him, people personalize Jefferson in ways that I don't think they do other presidents. Right. And so his reputation is sort of separate from the presidency. It's about, do we like him? And it's a fascinating thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And that was sort of what I was getting at. You know, it's often the case, particularly with presidents who are historic figures, who are kind of well known as presidents. And it's often the case that maybe they had sort of, problematic or colorful personal lives. But that often doesn't seem to detract from, you know, how they are held in high esteem. And I was curious if you think that all of this new scholarship on him as a person rather than a president, and I think it's also a function of he touches on so many areas beyond just politics.
I was going to say that. I mean, he's the thing is, you can be involved in some way, in quotes, with Jefferson, whether you care about politics or not. You know, it's music, it's architecture, it's, you know, botany, it's exploration, all kinds of things. And so there's so many different ways into him that he's a figure that's bigger, if you can say, than the presidency in a way. His image is much larger than contained in those 8 years when he was the president of the United States.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
Because of the Declaration, too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating to me. What you're suggesting really first dawned on me in graduate school, where most of this stuff that I was studying on Jefferson, you know, like the notes on the state of Virginia and others, really didn't have a lot to do with his presidency, just a lot more about kind of his cultural and intellectual contribution to early American society.
And Jefferson the man.
Absolutely.
As a person. And because, you know, he's involved. Here he sort of enters the consciousness because of the Declaration of Independence, and that's before the presidency. And, you know, people, that means a lot to people, the preamble, the thing that he's, you know, the words that people focus on most about the Declaration, you know, are associated with him. And so he means something to people beyond just the politics, but the politics come in as well. There's just a lot there.
I want to let our listeners know we are having a conversation on Thomas Jefferson today with Professor Annette Gordon Reed. She's a Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School. She's co-author of a new book on Thomas Jefferson called Most Blessed of the Patriarchs. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and your questions will reach me in the studio. You have any questions about Thomas Jefferson you've been dying to ask? Now would be a good time. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Professor Gordon Reed, let's start talking a little bit about your book. There are a couple of big concepts that jumped out at me that people might not be familiar with just from their general understanding of Thomas Jefferson. And the first one I wanted to tackle is this sort of, it's really right in the title that I just read, this idea of him as a patriarch of, you mentioned home, family, and country. Just so how did you sort of, how did this idea of thinking of him as a patriarch kind of come to you and your co-author, and why does it give us kind of a new lens on Jefferson?
Well, the title comes from a letter that he wrote to Angelica Schuyler Church about, as he's about to go off to Monticello from the cabinet wars that he had with Alexander Hamilton during the Washington administration. And he's writing to her sort of saying, you know, not licking his wounds, but, you know, in sort of a bravado, saying, well, you know, I'm going home to my fields, and I have my fields to form and to watch for the happiness of those who labor for mine, namely enslaved people. He also says, if my daughters join me in the area, I will consider myself to be as blessed as the most blessed of the patriarchs. Hmm. So the term most blessed of the patriarchs in the title is in quotes, because we're not calling him that. He's calling himself that. And we thought that that was an interesting thing for him to do. The patriarch is a word that you associate with olden days, ancient times, and Jefferson was supposedly, sort of famously, the harbinger of the new. He was supposed to be the apostle of democracy, believing in Republican government, Republican with a small r. And so how does he fit as this ancient figure that sort of evokes images of the past? In another letter, he says that he's living at Monticello once he's in retirement, those couple of years in the 1790s, living like an antediluvian patriarch on my farm. And we thought, again, this is interesting to see himself describe himself that way. So we wanted to figure out what he meant by that, how he came to be this figure, and what does it tell us about his understanding of his life? Because the purpose of the book is to, we think back up a little bit. We think that one of the things that's happened most recently for many decades now in writing about Jefferson is that people are sort of invested in being able to tell the readers what they think about what Jefferson is doing. Now, he should have done this. We think he should have been doing that. This book is to try to investigate what he thought he was doing in the world and to recapture his understanding of his purpose in life.
Well, It probably also gives us a window into his ambitions in terms of how he saw himself as a leader of the new nation, and you know his political ambitions to be president eventually.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's about what did this very fascinating figure think he was doing, and we think that that's kind of been lost in the scholarship either that is either there to try to to praise him unstintingly, or to criticize him unstintingly. So we wanted to talk about home, country, Virginia, those things that went into, this is the first section of the book, that went into making him who he was, a person who's born at the top of the social hierarchy in Virginia, an intelligent person, a person who had the best education that could be given to anybody at that time period, a person who was tall, which...
How tall was he?
Things.
Was he over
six
feet?
He's 6'2" and a half.
Wow.
He was taller than Washington. The only other person who was taller would be Lincoln.
Oh, interesting.
And that would have meant something during that time period. It means something now.
Sure.
And he was a firstborn son. And he was born into a family that owned other human beings. And, so he had all of the every single advantage that you could imagine was sort of encapsulated in this one person, who also, at some point in his life as a young man, decides that he wants to be associated with the Enlightenment, with progressive values.
Right.
And so we take this person who learns about the world through reading, a voracious reader, who had a scientific bent, who sort of thought that science was an example for life in general, that we would be... things would get better and better, and you would get new discoveries, and people would become more enlightened. And that's kind of difficult to take. I think we're a bit more, Peter and I think people are much more, we may be more cynical about things than he. So, yeah, so that's the start, to try to figure out how all these influences began to shape his understanding of what he was going to do in the world. And, of course, he begins to try this in the American Revolution.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned Hyde up until we have our first female presidential nominee. The conventional wisdom always was among political scientists that actually being taller as a male gives you a height, it gives you a actual advantage visually when you run for president. So it's, as you mentioned, the role of height among men at that time was not to be underestimated.
They said that about Washington. I mean, who could be more commanding in his uniform to come in and offer his services to the Continental Congress?
Right. The difference of stature. The other thing I should mention is probably most of our listeners, myself included, had not heard of Angelica Schuyler until the Hamilton musical has now made her and her sisters famous. So,
that's fascinating too, because we wrote this, we started writing this book well before this thing was out, before the play came out, and now people actually know who she is. They wouldn't have before.
Absolutely, and we'll talk a little bit later about how that musical, I think, is changing perceptions of the relationship between Jefferson and Hamilton specifically. But we do need to take a quick break. But coming up, we'll have more on the founding father, Thomas Jefferson. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. But stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're revisiting the legacy of Thomas Jefferson on this election day with Jefferson biographer Annette Gordon Reed. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Professor Gordon Reed is co-author with Peter Onuf of a new book, Most Blessed of the Patriarchs. It's a book about Thomas Jefferson. Professor, let's go back to talking about Jefferson in his home environment. I was fascinated in reading the book to get a better feel for his plantation life. I think we often think of him as a kind of an aristocrat on this sort of big, fancy, successful plantation. But the kind of feeling I get from the book is that, you know, he was sort of up and down in terms of his ability to have a successful plantation. And at least for part of his life, it was really kind of a wilderness frontier for his family.
Yes. He was interested in building a beautiful house on top of a mountain, which he did. And which is an odd and quixotic thing to do, task to take on, required a lot of work by enslaved people to sort of level a mountain. And it's not very practical. You know, how do you get water up the mountain? All kinds of things. But it's a beautiful vista. And he was not much interested in the day-to-day life of farming. We sort of suggest that, you know, Monticello is sort of a scene where he is a setting for him being, you know, part of the Republic of Letters, being a man of letters and welcoming visitors and so forth. The plantation was never particularly profitable. He got most of his income from his Bedford County estate, which were 90 miles away. And he was not really that successful as a farmer. When we point out that he, when he's in retirement, he turns over the farm to his grandson,
right?
And production sort of ramps up about three times the amount.
Wow.
Because his grandson really was focused on farming. Jefferson, first place, he was away a lot. The other thing about you don't think about the fact that he, for most of his adult career, professional career, he was at Monticello only, you know, half the time.
Right.
So it was difficult for him to manage things when he was in public service, essentially. But even when he got there, that was not his prime focus. He was a builder. He loved, he did woodworking himself. He liked architecture. He liked to have things, you know, pulling up and pulling down, he told a friend, was one of his favorite occupations. But that's not agriculture. So
right.
He's known for his championing of farming and so forth, but it was more it was not something that he was personally that interested in.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book the influence of his time in France in the 1780s on his love of architecture and kind of bringing some of that back to buildings in the United States. And I want to talk a little bit about this time in France. It was interesting to me, again, this is another one of these misconceptions that I think the book takes on in a very interesting way. I think people often think of him as kind of a globe-trotting aristocrat, who's off in France. And then as the Hamilton musical says, he comes back and asks, so what did I miss? The reality was, from the writing of you and Professor Onuf, that actually being in France kind of made him appreciate Virginia and America more. Not exactly. He didn't. I think they use the phrase "go native" to describe kind of Ben Franklin and his experience in France.
Uh-huh.
Whereas this actually sort of the effect on Jefferson was maybe not what people typically think.
No, because I think people mistake his love of the culture, of the architecture, the music, and music was, he said, the favorite passion of people. If you can imagine what it must have been like, sort of orchestras and opera and all the kinds of things that are in Paris during this time period. So he loved all of that, but the culture, the family, French families, the culture was one thing, but the social life, French families, women who are sort of messing in politics, who are sort of, he says, out in the streets, by themselves, mm-hmm. all those kinds of things really shocked him. And he began to say, well, you know, we may have problems in Virginia and we may be, you know, rustic, but, you know, we're not like this. He saw this as decadent. And it gave him a renewed appreciation for American, you know, what America could do. So that he developed this idea of the sort of, you know, pure, Native American, not Native American, but, you know, the American values,
right,
that were going to make Republican society successful, and that this was, you know, the old regime French decadence was something to be avoided. He learned a lot in Paris. By the way, what did I miss? I think that's hysterically funny because, of course, he's writing to Madison all the time about the Constitution.
Right.
He knows what's going on. And France was the place where he learned about diplomacy and economics, to the extent that he knew about economics, from dealing with people there. So it was a marvelous learning experience for him.
We're having a conversation this morning on Thomas Jefferson with Harvard Law Professor Annette Gordon-Reed. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. It's a great time to get your Thomas Jefferson questions answered. And let's go to the phones. And we have Warren joining us from Wolfboro. Warren, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you.
Your question.
My question is for your presenter.
Sure.
I didn't get her name because I was in voting.
Well, that's good. Good to vote.
But the question has to do with, I would like her to comment on Jefferson's role in the slave revolt in Haiti and his later backing or concurrent backing of the French against the slave revolt out of a fear of a slave revolt in the United States.
Interesting. Professor Gordon-Reed?
Yes, that is one of the problematic aspects of Jefferson's life and understanding, because the first letter that I've seen when he's talking about the revolt in Haiti, or Saint-Domingue as it was called then, to his daughter. He basically says, the Negroes have, taken over and, formed a regular form of government. And this is what's going to happen all along in the West Indies. So he sort of sounds like, this is the age of revolution and this is what's going to happen. But then when he begins to get reports of white people being killed, in large numbers, and that there's violence, then his tune changes altogether. And he, exactly as the caller said, he's fearful that all of the refugees, sometimes the slave owners, are coming up from Saint-Domingue to Norfolk and to Philadelphia, and they're bringing enslaved people with them. If the fear is that the enslaved people in Virginia, blacks in Virginia and other parts of the South, when they hear about this, are going to be influenced, and it's going to come, the contagion will come to America, and there will be violence. And so he does not champion, while he does champion the French Revolution, far longer than, people think he should have, even after people are getting their heads chopped off, people that he knows. He is fearful about Saint-Domingue because he thinks that this is what's going to happen in Virginia. Enslaved people are going to rise up and kill us here. Mm-hmm. And so, he doesn't support Haiti. Mm-hmm. Later in life, he says he would have recognized Haiti. But maybe he says white people will not allow it. They're too prejudiced to do this. So it's like he doesn't think he's prejudiced, which is kind of funny. It's those other white people who are prejudiced against them.
Warren, thanks for that call. We've talked a little bit about France now. I'm interested to get your sense of how the whole French experience with the revolution in the 1780s, how that influenced his own thinking about kind of the sort of political future of the United States and, his notion of how to function as Secretary of State and later as president?
Well, I think the French, it sort of gave him a sense that sort of fit in with his notion of, a sort of Republican ascendancy in the world, that, eventually he thought that everything was going to work out there, and it did not. So I think it helped him learn about how to function as a diplomat. He met people. He understood, how things were done. I think he was a person in Virginia, somewhat a provincial, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't really have. He never took the grand tour. He didn't, as a young man, he didn't have experiences that other people had. And I think that France gave him a sense of sophistication about deal making, certainly, and how to function. And so I think it helped him as Secretary of State see the world in a broader sense than he would have if he had just remained in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back for a moment and talk about the concept of family. This really is something that is central, certainly to the first part of the book, but kind of the thesis of the book in general. And ask you to talk a little bit about your own earlier work. And I remember when that work came out, taking on sort of the Jefferson scholars and the prevailing ideas about whether or not Thomas Jefferson had fathered children with Sally Hemings. And one of the interesting things in the book to me was, you know, there's sort of this sort of public portrayal in letters of Jefferson and his family. But the reality is these other children that it now sounds like through DNA evidence have been confirmed as his were really kind of an integral part of his life, regardless of where he was in Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I think made it difficult for people to accept the story, mm-hmm. because it would mean that you would have to look at his family very differently. And there was a very, very set picture of what Jefferson's family life was like. And so if you add, four children to the mix and an enslaved woman as a mistress, you have to think about things differently. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that when Jefferson is going to Poplar Forest, mm-hmm. he takes his sons along with him. And if you look at letters from his granddaughters talking about their right. time at Poplar Forest, they don't mention these people. So, I mean, one of the things about historians, I mean, obviously we look at documents. We use documents to tell us what the world was like, letters. But because the letters that people were focusing on never mentioned these kids, you don't have to imagine them. But these other letters that I talk about in my book show that they were there. So you have to reimagine Jefferson's world and how this was accomplished. And one of the things that made people so upset about this, contemporaries, people who were writing about it at the time, was that the children were there. I mean, if he had other plantations, he could have had Sally Hemings and these children some other place. Mm-hmm. But they were saying, you're living with this person, you know, doing this around your legal white family. And people thought that was particularly scandalous. But he did. So you have to think about, and we'll never be able to really know, because this was something that was not talked about their family.
So
have to imagine what this was like.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating to me as someone who has done my own archival research. What you essentially did, from my understanding, is you kind of found other sources and letters and kind of contemporaneous accounts that sort of suggested that these were actually his children.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, you can't go. I think what people thought was, let's just go look at what his family is saying about this.
Right.
Well, of course, his family, they're not the source. We would sort of laugh at that if you were to say, you know, I know all about the Bush family or the Clinton family or any modern family because we read their family's memoirs. Mm-hmm. You'd say, no, maybe we need to go outside of that and try to find stuff. And that's what I did in the first book, was to try to look at letters from his friends, look at other sources, to try to pull this together to see what people were saying about it. And, you know, his visits, noticing when he comes to Monticello and when he leaves and when she conceives children, mm-hmm. looking at the names of these kids who are all named for his best friends mm-hmm. and favorite relatives, you know, that kind of stuff, not just what does his grandchild say about this? Because what else are they going to say except this is not my family, because they would be hurt by that.
We're having a conversation with Professor Annette Gordon-Reed of Harvard Law School on her new co-authored book on Thomas Jefferson, Most Blessed of the Patriarchs. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Boy, there's still so much to talk about. I'd like to shift a little bit and talk about a few of the kind of non-political aspects of his interests. Particularly, let's start with religion. Religion is one of those things with Thomas Jefferson I'm always fascinated by, because it sounds like he believed in God, but he was not a fan of clerical religion, yet other people refer to him as an atheist. Can you help us sort out his views on religion?
Well, he was not an atheist. he did believe in, as you said, he did believe in God. He did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ. Hmm. He didn't think that Jesus right. was the Son of God and a supernatural being, he would have said, who performed miracles. And I'm here in Manhattan, if you're hearing this in the background. Mm-hmm. He didn't believe that Jesus performed miracles. He thought that Jesus' teachings were, he would say, the most sublime moral teachings that have ever been produced, and you should follow Jesus' teachings, but not think of Jesus as a God. So he actually, that's why he crafted what has been called the Jefferson Bible, which he called the Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, not Jesus Christ, but mm-hmm. Jesus of Nazareth, he takes a razor and scissors out and you know, cuts out all of the parts of the Bible that he thinks are supernatural things that were grafted onto the story of Jesus that Jesus never mm-hmm. said he did. So, of course, he does this very much in secret. His family did not know that he had done this until really late, and he was not telling people what he was doing, no one in his family what he was doing. He certainly did not announce it to the world what he was doing, because that would have been, if you'd imagine how people would feel if, you know, President Jefferson cut up the Bible, that would be a problem now.
Sure.
And but people understood that he was skeptical of organized religion, and his call for a separation of church and state, people interpreted that as hostility to religion.
Right.
But he actually thought it would be a way for people's own religious views to flower, but under their own conscience, you know, that it was a matter of conscience for them, not something that would be imposed on them by other people. He really did not like the idea of other people imposing religious views onto other individuals. He didn't even think that kids should be indoctrinated in religion, that people should come of age and then study mm-hmm. and come to their own conclusion about what religion was best for them. And so you could see that would not have been the thinking of people during that time period. It's kind of right. radical, I think, for right. today even.
So the separation of church and state, I think, a lot, as you mentioned, a lot of people often see that as kind of anti-religious. He saw it as actually a way that you could kind of freely practice your religion in a kind of a small-R Republican political setting.
Yes, exactly. And that's what happened. I mean, in the United States, we have this, you know, through various Supreme Court decisions. Well, I mean, the Constitution interpretation, you know, separation of church and state. And Americans are far more religious than our Western European counterparts. Church attendance, belief, and that flourished, actually, in a regime of separation of church and state, which is what he thought would happen. And he had his own religious views, but he didn't bother. He didn't think that anybody else should impose those on other people. So he would be fine with the flourishing of religion.
We have to take one more quick break, but coming up, we'll continue to talk about the contradictions of Founding Father Thomas Jefferson. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, author Annette Gordon-Reed, author of a new biography on Thomas Jefferson. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. And Professor Gordon-Reed, let's go to the phones. We have Amy joining us from Exeter. Amy, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have a question for Professor Gordon-Reed. I'm a U.S. history teacher going on maybe 20 years now, and I perennially wrestle with this phrase that Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, that they are endowed by their creator with equal rights, and my students wonder, how can he have written that? And I just wondered if Professor Gordon-Reed could talk about what Jefferson meant when he said that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable mm-hmm. rights. Did he mean to include slaves?
Great question, Amy. Professor?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the Declaration was a statement that was designed to justify the United States, justify the American people breaking away to form their own country. And all men are created equal is both a statement of something that he believed. I do think he believed that enslaved people were people. That's why he believed that slavery was an injustice, and that in the fullness of time that it would be eradicated as people became more enlightened. That's a difficult position for us to take, to accept, because we think that if you believe that, you should go out and do it immediately. That was not, in his view, something that could be accomplished in his time under what he would call Republican means. That is to say, the people of Virginia, the white people of Virginia, were not going to vote to end slavery. And so, you know, that was not going to happen. And I think he was right in that assessment of it, that what had to happen was that people had to be educated. And with enlightenment, people would recognize that slavery was not only wrong, it was an actual threat to Republican society, that it could not exist in a truly Republican society. So I do believe that he thought, I mean, from other writings, that slavery was wrong. But I also think that there are a lot of things that we believe, that we have an intellectual belief in, but that we don't act on. And that's, I don't think that he's unusual in that sense. So he's making a universal statement about the nature of mankind, and he's also making a statement about the right of Americans to take their place among the nations of the earth as equal, in an equal station. But there's no question that there's a problem, because how often do people say they believe one thing, but then they don't act on it? They don't have, for whatever lots of reasons that we could talk about, don't have the capacity to, you know, to live up to their ideals.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was going to say the interesting thing about him is that Doug Wilson, who'd written an article about a historian who'd written an article about Jefferson for the Atlantic, said the interesting thing about him is not that he had these particular contradictions. The interesting thing is that someone of his station, of his class, actually came to say that slavery was wrong, because most of his cohort didn't even acknowledge that, didn't believe that that was the case. So there's a problem here with a sense of contradiction, but it isn't something that strikes me as, well, I mean, human beings are complicated people. There are a lot of things that that we believe that we don't immediately act upon, particularly when it demands that your community go along with it. And he looked at his community and he realized that they were not ready. And so he basically devoted his life to fulfilling the American Revolution, the promise of the American Revolution. That was his obsession. He did not think about slavery in the way that we did. He thought that was a problem that was going to solve itself. He was wrong. But he was right in thinking that the only way it was going to be solved, or could be solved, would be through either enlightenment or war. And what happened was war.
Mm-hmm. Amy, thanks for that call. Professor Gordon Reed, let's turn our attention now to the big political conflicts of the 1790s. This would be his battles with Hamilton and his campaign against Adams. And to sort of start us off, Ella sends us an email, and she asks, why was Jefferson so vicious and muckraking to John Adams in 1799? And we're also going to add in Steve calling us from Nottingham. Steve, welcome to the Exchange.
First of all, I want to put a shout out that I was just voted, and the turnout was large in Nottingham, and I'm just pleased to say that maybe there's some good stuff going on in that. And everyone talks about the election as being so filthy and name-calling. And I wanted to go back to that election with Jefferson and Adams. Mm-hmm. And I recall one story in which Adams said the other one was dead. They circulated that rumor. And I said to him, we talk about how vicious can you get?
Yeah, Steve, let's see what the professor has to say. John Adams, the relationship with John Adams is fascinating. We know they were friends. They had a falling out, and then there was sort of an attempt through Abigail Adams to reconcile. Could you say a little bit about sort of the politics around around their competition for president?
Well, it was a vicious campaign. Actually, it was the Federalists who sent the rumor that Jefferson was dead. And that was, as I said, this pretty vicious thing to do. Jefferson supported a man named James Callender, who had been writing terrible things about John Adams. Jefferson thought that the Federalist Party, Hamilton and Adams, and who were in the Federalist Party, he saw them as counter-revolutionaries. One of the things I should have said before is that the central thing in Jefferson's life, the central obsession in his life, was his role as an American revolutionary and the development of the United States. And he saw Hamilton and Adams as pursuing policies that were too much in favor of Great Britain. Jefferson came to hate mm-hmm. Great Britain after the Revolution, and did not want anything that was, you know, smacked of being related to the British system in America. And Hamilton had wanted, for example, as I'm sure you know, had argued at one point for the president to serve for life.
Right. Yep.
And
life, yep.
A Senate to serve for life on good behavior. And Jefferson heard this and went, you know, ballistic. So how have we gotten rid of a king and suggest that, you know, we can have a monarch, you can have a person who could serve for life? And Hamilton's answer was, well, you know, it's not a monarchy because it's not hereditary. Mm-hmm. But for Jefferson, it was the concentration of power in one person for their entire life was too much. Adams was not, I mean, was somewhere in between the two of them. And Jefferson did have follow policies, the Alien and Sedition Act, which, you know, punished people for saying bad things about, you know, the leader, every leader except the vice president. Right. And Jefferson was vice president at that time. So he was left out of it. You could say slanderous things about him, but not about other officials. So there was nastiness on both sides. And there's no question about that. But after being great friends, having this falling out, I'm sure everybody knows at the end of their lives, they came back together, forming a correspondence that it lasted until their death. And they tried to explain themselves to one another, and because Adams had said we should not die before we have explained ourselves to one another. And they tried to do that. I don't know. I mean, they didn't always mm-hmm. achieve success, but the love that they had for one another came back when they were old men and realized and got out of the political battles. Jefferson said, let's leave the politics of the past behind and go forward just as friends, which they mm-hmm. managed to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of shifting alliances during this period of the 1790s just really fascinates me. You know, my students, they're always really interested to learn after, you know, we read the Federalist Papers early on in our semester, and they see Hamilton allied with Madison mm-hmm. in this enterprise. And then all of a sudden we switch into the 1790s with the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, and suddenly Madison is allied with Jefferson.
A
little bit about that transformation, how it came about.
Well, they had been friends. I mean, they met when Jefferson was governor, the war governor in Virginia, and they became close. They corresponded while Jefferson went off to France and became good friends. When Jefferson comes back and sees all that, and he's the one who's encouraging Madison to have a Bill of Rights, he didn't think was needed at first, but he convinces him that. Madison comes under the influence of Jefferson, really, and he switches positions. And this is the Madison switch is the thing right. that people try to explain all the time what happened. It could be so much as, you know, sometimes it's not that terribly complicated. Other than that, he really came to value Jefferson's friendship, and Jefferson influenced him. And so he changes his views about this, about the Constitution. He had actually at one point, you know, favored this notion of an executive that served for life as well. Mary Bilder has written a book called Madison's Hand that talks about the shift in Madison's thinking. But they became great friends, and the great collaboration is what they call it. They worked together for the rest of Jefferson's, you know, political life and Madison's political life. He just came under the influence of Jefferson and left Hamilton and the Federalists behind. Mm-hmm. So it was a change. People don't understand how that could happen, but I think one thing to keep in mind is that people do change.
Sure,
you know, I mean, it's this notion that people have to be consistent over the span of their lifetime is just not really realistic. I mean, all I have to do is go back and read my diary when I was in college at Dartmouth,
yeah.
And I'm thinking aghast at the stuff that I thought then. But even you change life circumstances, the people you meet, people make arguments to you that convince you. So I don't think it's. I think we like to portray this. Sometimes I think it helps with the drama of writing.
Sure.
To talk about, well, there's this big contradiction, there's this big shift, and what it is just that you get to be older and you
right.
have different influences
different
and you say, aha, I was wrong about that. There's nothing, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. In
yep.
fact, that's what you want to see.
I should mention you are a graduate of Dartmouth College. There's a nice New Hampshire connection there for us.
Yep.
I want to ask you if this is something I've always wondered, and it's something that I teach, but I'm curious to get your take on it. You know, in the 1790s, Jefferson and Madison are this sort of Democratic Republicans who were concerned about centralization of executive power in the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
But then Jefferson becomes president, and there's some suggestion by some scholars that he becomes a lot more comfortable with the notion of centralized presidential power when he's the guy in office. And we get the kind of the Louisiana Purchase and some other actions that really kind of diverge a bit from what he was saying in the 1790s. I'm interested to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, well, it's along the lines that I'm saying before. It's a different perspective.
Yeah.
You get into office, and you have an opportunity to double the size of the United States. You think that maybe we need a constitutional amendment to do this, and he actually
mm-hmm.
drafts one, but
mm-hmm.
then puts it away in the drawer, deciding that he doesn't. You take this action or not, and he decided to take action by sort of convincing himself that, you know, that self-preservation required that the United States get as much territory as they possibly can to remove America from European balance of power politics and wars and so forth. If you take the entire continent, you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. So, yeah, he does use executive power. He likes it because he trusts himself.
not the only presidential candidate ever to make that transition once
in
office.
I mean,
it's pretty
Look
standard for presidents.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're outside of office. You
yeah.
don't know. You could argue about a president's foreign policy decisions, all those kinds of things. But once you're sitting in the chair, you have to think about things in a different way.
Right. Right. One other area that I want to talk about in terms of his presidency is, you know, the sort of the historical view of Washington was that, you know, he wanted sort of dominion over the executive branch, but pretty hands-off guy when it came to Congress. Whereas, you know, a lot of people think of Jefferson as really the first president to use the idea of a party caucus in Congress to kind of bring the executive branch and Congress into kind of a closer alignment in terms of an agenda. Is that a fair assessment to say he's really kind of the first partisan president, or is that an overstatement?
No, I think he is the first he's the partisan president because he had the capacity. He felt he had a mandate
mm-hmm.
To do that. And he really did believe in he respected legislative power because the legislature is supposedly closer to the people. And sort of doing the will of the people, I think he would say, required this kind of cooperation. And he did govern by dinner parties, govern by having his finger on the pulse of everything that's happening in Washington and in the legislature. And so, yeah, he definitely used those things to use the legislature and his connection to them to get policies through. And it's an interesting moment because it's all new,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's not – we're thinking of this – you can't think of it as a system that's fully formed. He's trying out lots of different things, different ways to govern. And he was more in the first term successful at doing that.
I want to close by coming back around to something in the third part of your book, and that's the sort of the impact of music on Jefferson's life, music and the arts. But in particular, you talk a lot about kind of his love of music, and just talk for a minute or so about kind of his love of that and how it influenced him.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something, it's sort of a strange thing to include in the book, a chapter in the midst of talking about politics and other things. But he said music was the favorite passion of his soul. And he played the violin. There's some indication that he might have played the cello as well, but he sang. People who knew him said that he was always singing to himself or singing out loud, actually, when he's riding around Monticello, and he sang for people. And it's a different view of him to think of this person who, you know, who for whom music was sort of like a background. It was a background requirement. You could imagine him, how he would feel today with music available every place. And, you know, his daughters played the harpsichord. He married a woman who was a good singer and played the harpsichord. His children with Sally Hemings, all three of the sons played the violin. One of them actually made a living as a musician playing the violin, and his signature song was one of Jefferson's favorites.
And I should mention, Professor Gordon Reed, we are out of time now, and we are going, as you mentioned, we're going to close on the music of Corelli, who was one of Thomas Jefferson's favorite composers. And Professor Gordon Reed, I want to thank you so much. This was a wonderful conversation to have on Election Day.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Annette Gordon Reed. She is co-author with Peter Onuf of Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of Imagination. She's a Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School. Remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. And I'm Dean Spiliotis for Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.